Court, I'm Joe Cruz of Dallas, and I represent the injured workers, plaintiffs below, petitioners in this court. This is a workers' compensation case that was resolved by a summary judgment motion below, and the issue for this court to determine is whether there was a genuine issue of material fact regarding whether the plaintiffs below, Mr. Evans and Mr. Brody, were in the course and scope of their employment, or whether they were on a special mission at the time they received their injuries. If so, as we contend, they were entitled to workers' compensation benefits, which were denied to them below. The trial court granted the insurance company's motion for summary judgment and denied the plaintiff's motion for partial summary judgment as to liability. The Court of Appeals in Dallas affirmed, which brings us to this court. There are two significant points that I will address in my argument. First, procedurally, it's our contention that there are genuine issues of material fact that would have made it inappropriate for the courts below to grant and affirm the granting of the summary judgment motion, given the sparse state of the summary judgment record. And substantively, that Brody and Evans were indeed engaged in a special mission, as that term is defined and interpreted by judicial pronouncements in this state at the time that they received their serious injuries. Parenthetically, let me point out at this point, on Friday of last week, I was served with the respondent's motion to take judicial notice that was recently filed before this court. I oppose that motion and will address that substantively in my rebuttal argument unless the court has some questions about it now, but I believe pursuant to Rule 19 of the Rules of Appellate Procedure, I'm allowed 10 days to respond. I would point out that the respondent did not ask that the response time be shortened when it filed this motion, and under Rule 201E of the Texas Rules of Civil Evidence, I believe that I'm entitled, upon timely request, the opportunity to be heard as to the propriety of taking judicial notice, and I certainly so request. But again, substantively, I'll address that in my rebuttal argument briefly. I believe that since this is a summary judgment case, that obviously the uncontested summary judgment evidence and facts are salient, if not determinative. There are a number of facts I would point out to the court that are referred to in the respondent's brief as being uncontested, and they're not. There are contested issues of fact that are incorrectly labeled as uncontested in their brief. What we do know, and what there is no dispute about, is that these workers, Evans and Brody, were hired on September 17, 1986, to work at a specific job site, the Range Creek Bridge job site up in Grayson County. They were construction workers. They were hired to work on that job site, and they worked on that job site beginning at 8 o'clock each morning and working till the end of the day for that entire week. We know that at the end of that week, the first week of their employment, that their foreman or supervisor approached them and told them that they were not to report on the following workday, which was the Monday, February the 24th. They were not to report to the job site. They were instead to report to a safety meeting that was located approximately 7.5 miles away from the actual job site where they worked. We know that they had not completed their work at the job site because the work at the Range Creek Bridge job site continued even up through the time of the Blahock deposition. That's part of the summary judgment record. This foreman also informed them to report at a different time, 7:30 a.m. instead of 8 o'clock a.m. on that next work day.
Do they get paid for the safety meeting? Do they punch in at 7:30 or whenever they get there or what?
I think the summary judgment evidence, Your Honor, is that their time began, although I'm not sure there was a clock, but their time began when they arrived at the safety meeting. They were paid for being present at the safety meeting. Now, we also know that this particular employer had as its office a trailer, the only office that it had in the state of Texas, a trailer that was located in Tioga, Texas. They had a shop site which was a different facility that was located a mile and a half from the trailer. All of these were located, however, 7 to 7.5 miles away from the actual field construction site, the job site. The purpose of the safety meetings, we know from the unrefuted summary judgment evidence, was to benefit the employer. It was, as Mr. Blahock testified, to promote safety in the company, to lower insurance premiums, and to be in the interest of the company. There was no direct benefit to the employee, at least in terms of special mission, the parameters of special mission law. We know that at the time of the accident, which occurred at 7:20 a.m. the morning of February 24th, that Mr. Brody and Mr. Evans were on their way to the safety meeting, which was to begin at 7:30 that morning. And they were going to the safety meeting at their employer's direction.
How is this any different from going to work at a safety meeting and going to work? Still travel to work. If you consider going to safety meeting work, travel is not compensable in the statute.
I agree with that concept. The reason it's different is for the same reasons that the courts, this court held in two cases collectively known as the water jug cases. Because the employer specifically directed the employee to go somewhere other than work. Work was not the safety meeting. Work for Brody and Evans was at the construction job site.
Well, they were going to get paid to listen to some lectures. Why is that not work?
For the same reason that it wasn't work in the Janik and Johnson water jug cases, where the employer directed the employee to go do something before they actually got to the construction job site. And either on the way there or after they had gone there, they received some injuries and the court held that they were compensable under this special mission exception. It's clearly an exception to the to and from rule.
If the safety meeting had been held at the construction job site where they were ordinarily working and they were injured on the way to it, would that be compensable or non-compensable?
Assuming that the other facts remain the same, I believe that it would not be compensable because then they would be proceeding to work. And that would come under the to and from rule.
If we're held at the trailer, you would say it was compensable?
I would say it's compensable.
If there were two job sites and they worked sometimes at one and sometimes at the other and the safety meeting was at the other one from where they were working on Friday, compensable or non-compensable?
It's not compensable, and that's the alternative job site cases that are cited in both of our briefs. Actually, the only alternative job site case is one where, or usually the way this fact situation comes up is that you've got a job site and the work has been completed at that job site. The employee is then instructed to go to another job site and perhaps on the way to the second job site there's an injury, not compensable to and from, you're going to work. But that's not the case here and those aren't the facts here.
Does the summary judgment record reflect whether the safety meeting is on the way to work?
The summary judgment record is conflicting in that respect, and that's the reason that I think the cautious approach for this court would be to reverse and remand for further proceedings in the trial court.
Does it make any difference whether it's on the way to work or in the other direction? Would employees live all different directions from the job site? So whether the safety meeting happened to be on the way to work or in some other direction, would it make any difference?
You're talking about the route?
Yes.
Specific route? Well, that's certainly a contention. It was raised by me in my motion for partial summary judgment below. It was addressed in the respondent's brief at the appellate court level, and it's also the specific subject of the respondent's motion to take notice of facts, which I believe would be inappropriate to do, and I'll address that subsequently. But the answer is that it's our contention, and I think special mission law in Texas is, that if the employee is directed to attend the safety meeting, and if, just as if the employee had been directed to go to a physical for a doctor, for a workup before he started work, and assuming that the safety meeting or the doctor's office is not at the job site where the employee is assigned to work, that's a special mission. And if you...
whether he's on the way or not.
Whether he's on the way or not. And all of the special mission cases don't distinguish between whether or not he got to the safety meeting or the doctor's office. Because indeed, if Brody and Evans, and this is the basic fallacy of the respondent's argument here, if Brody and Evans had gotten to the safety meeting, we wouldn't be talking about special mission, because then they would be in the course and scope of their employment. Had they gotten to the safety meeting, they would have been on the clock, would have been paid for what they were doing, and regardless of what happened thereafter, they would have been in course and scope. The effect of the respondent's argument here is the respondent is essentially asking this court to, I think, somewhat radically narrow and limit and restrict the scope of the special mission doctrine in this state.
If it were the employee's regular duty on every Monday morning to report to another site for a safety meeting, would the injury on the way be compensable or not compensable?
I think that's a difficult question, Your Honor. There are no summary, that's a refuted fact in this case. There's conflicting evidence. The summary judgment evidence presented by Mr. Brody by way of his affidavit and the summary judgment evidence presented by Mr. Blahock by way of his deposition are conflicting on that point. My contention is that that's a fact question for the jury to determine. That is, whether or not the fact that they have a safety meeting every Monday morning, if they do, would constitute the safety meeting site being an alternate job site. I think the case law, from a legal standpoint, is against that proposition. My contention is that the fact that they had it regularly on every Monday morning, if they did, is not dispositive. It's merely a fact question to be presented to the jury along with the other fact questions for them to make the determination as to whether it was a course and scope or a special mission case. And keep in mind, of course, that this is a summary judgment case, and procedurally, plaintiffs filed a motion for partial summary judgment as to the issue of liability. Defendants responded by filing a motion for summary judgment on the entire case. The only summary judgment evidence that's before the court, before any court below, are the admissions of the insurance company, which are of record Rule 169 admissions, the affidavit of the surviving plaintiff, Larry Brody, and the unobjected to portions of the deposition of Thomas Blahock. I would point out to the court, it's of record that I filed objections to the portions of Mr. Blahock's deposition that I think would not be admissible. The respondent in this case has, I think, a substantial burden, and that is to show entitlement to summary judgment on the issues that were expressly presented to the court. And I will admit to this court that not many issues below were that express. In my motion for partial summary judgment, I just asked the court to find that as a matter of law, they were on a special mission, they were in the course and scope. In the defendant's motion for summary judgment, represented by different counsel than counsel here today, they moved the court to find as a matter of law that they were entitled to judgment in that the plaintiffs were not in the course and scope and were not on a special mission. The court must view this evidence, I think, in a light most favorable to the non-movement, which are the plaintiffs in this case, and must resolve the reasonable inferences and any doubts in favor of the non-movement. I think the court has made that fairly clear, even in its most recent reiteration of those concepts last week in Guarantee Federal Savings Bank versus Horseshoe Operating Company. The other presumption that I would ask the court to keep in mind in terms of parameters here is the presumption that we're entitled to under the workers' compensation laws. As reiterated as recently, I believe, in the Lujan versus Houston General case, that those laws are to be liberally construed in favor of protecting the worker, because that's the purpose of the act. Viewing the summary judgment evidence scant as it is, with those presumptions against summary judgment and in favor of workers under the Workers' Compensation Act, we believe that the granting of the summary judgment motion for the respondent below was error. The material facts that are at issue and the reason that the granting below was error, the work hours, whether the actual work hours were to begin on February 24, 1986, the day of the accident, at 7:30, as the insurance company now contends, as opposed to 8 o'clock. And I would point out to the court in the Brody affidavit that he specifically says that if he and Evans had not been instructed to attend the safety meeting at 7:30 that morning, they, quote, would have appeared for work at 8 a.m. at the normal place of employment, the Range Creek job site. There are a number of other references in the Brody affidavit about these matters, but I think that that statement in and of itself creates a genuine issue of material fact on the issue of whether the work was to begin at 7:30 or whether that was actually the safety meeting was not work. Now, the issue of whether the safety meeting was an alternate job site is a separate issue. Why are the plaintiffs and petitioners entitled to partial summary judgment? I would argue that because even if you assume that all of the evidence that was submitted in the summary judgment record is true, that as a matter of law, you have to find that the plaintiffs below were on a special mission, which is an exception to the to and from rule. Getting into the substantive argument about special mission. The case authority here is scanty, but shows that if an employer directs an employee from one place to another for the benefit of the employer, that is a special mission and an exception to the to and from rule, even if the employee never arrived. A question raised in the respondent's brief is whether or not the employee received any benefit, or whether the acts to be taken by the employee were in the benefit or furthering the interest of the employer. I think the summary judgment record is sound on that point, is unrefuted. This was obviously a direct personal benefit, no direct personal benefit to the plaintiffs, the injured persons. It was a specific benefit, as the summary judgment record shows, to the employer. It was the employer who had a contract with the Corps of Engineers on this job that required it to hold safety meetings. It was the employer and not the plaintiffs who were seeking to lower its insurance premiums. The travel then clearly had to do with the interest of the employer as opposed to the personal interest of the employee. I would point out to the court that there are a line of cases under the so-called temporary direction exception, and beginning with Biggs versus U.S. Fire Insurance Company, this court's opinion in 1981, and I would point out to the court that no effort was made to refute those cases, to distinguish those cases, or to argue that issue in the respondent's brief. There has not been a tremendous amount of litigation in this area. For that reason, I have cited the court to a few cases in other jurisdictions where the facts, I think, are pretty much the same. And I would point out that the respondent has not attempted to distinguish those cases either. The two cases that I would highlight are the Utah Supreme Court case in 1984, where, with a similar fact situation, where a claimant was on her way to a training program at the employer's central facilities, which was different than the employee's normal job site, the court held there that it was a special mission and it was entitled to coverage under the comp laws. And similarly, in the Missouri case, Delosier versus Munley Construction Company, the claimant there was killed in a traffic accident while reporting to work 30 minutes early, as instructed to do by the employer, not to the normal work site, but to a concrete batch plant to supervise preparation of concrete for the employer, being therefore in the benefit and interest of the employer. The court found that that was a special mission and that the employee was entitled to comp benefits.
Would it be a special mission if the employer just said arrive 30 minutes early for a safety meeting at the job site?
For so long as it was at the job site, I think the fact that the employer asked the employer, instructs the employee to come at a different time, is only an issue, not a dispositive issue. And I think that if, instead of them telling Mr. Brody and Mr. Evans that they had to go 7.5 miles to a different location for the meeting, that they were supposed to come to the job site and have their safety discussion at that point, we wouldn't be here today, because I think that falls under the to and from rule and is not a special mission case.
Any other questions? Thank you, Judge. The court is ready to hear argument from response.
May it please the court, Mr. Susan Lawhead and Mr. Jeff Bogus will present argument for petitioners and respondents. Ms. Lawhead, go ahead.
May it please the court. My name is Susan Lawhead, and with my co-counsel, Jeff Boggess, I'm here to represent Illinois Insurance of Wausau, responding in this case. It is respondent's contention that there are two issues to be decided in this case, whether workman's compensation law was properly applied, and the propriety of the granting of the summary judgment. As this court stated in Gibbs v. General Motors, summary judgment for a defendant movement is proper when at least one essential element of the plaintiff's cause of action has been conclusively negated by the summary judgment proof. The courts below found that this stringent requirement had been met by the respondent in this case. It is important to note at the outset in evaluating the burden of proof in this case that it was petitioners that filed their motion for partial summary judgment first.
Why is that important?
I think it's important because Wausau met its burden of proof in responding to petitioner's motion. Petitioner did not meet the burden of proof in responding to Wausau's motion for judgment on the entire case, which was supported by a brief pointing to summary judgment evidence.
But the granting of a summary judgment in your favor stands or falls on what you, on the record, not on any deficiencies on the other side.
Yes, Your Honor. We understand that. We're not shifting the burden of proof. We're not arguing that here today. The issue in this case, as petitioners contend themselves, was stated well by this court in the Meyer case, in which they asked the question, were these people already working, or were they simply traveling to work? And the answer in the instant case is they were simply on the way to work. Moreover, even if they had met one of the four statutory exceptions to the coming and going rule, this court's decision in Bottom required that they still must satisfy the other two prongs of the course of employment test, that the injuries be of the kind and character originating in employer's business, and that they be engaged at the time of the accident in furtherance of employer's business. Respondent contends that all three issues were negated conclusively by the summary judgment proof and that the burden of proof therefore shifted to plaintiff to respond.
Well, if they were on a job site and the supervisor told them to go back to the trailer and on the way to the trailer they got hit by a train, wouldn't that be a compensable injury or not?
Yes, Your Honor, it would. This case is different because they had not yet begun to work.
So doesn't this all boil down to whether or not they were on the job at the time the train hit them?
That's right. Yes.
If the supervisor had said, stop by the donut place on the way to work this morning and pick up some donuts, would the auto injury to them between the donut house and the job site be compensable?
Your Honor, that would turn on several issues. First of all, it would depend on whether the donut shop was on the regular route to work.
What difference does that make?
The courts have said that if a less convenient route is taken to work, then the deviated portion of the trip no longer serves the personal interest of the employee, who is normally considered to be on a personal errand when he's on the way to work, as this court stated in Johnson.
Well, does that mean in this case that if the employee lived on the other side of the safety meeting from the job site, that his injury is compensable, but if the employee lived on opposite side, since he had to go further, it wouldn't be compensable. What sense does that make?
No, Your Honor, we don't contend that it makes sense at all. We don't feel that this case it should turn on the deviation issue. We feel that it's not a special mission. And the main reason for that is, as this court stated in Janak, it's a simple matter. If they're not having been performing any function as they travel down the highway, and in Texas, the law is settled that it's not a deviation unless they also it's not a special mission unless they also satisfy that requirement. But I do feel that the deviation issue can also be answered, and when I address the map later, I will try to answer your question.
Well, before you move on to another point, getting back to whether or not the attending of a safety meeting inures to the benefit of the employer, do you challenge a statement made here the summary judgment record supports the proposition that your employer or the people you represent would have lower insurance rates because of the safety meeting?
No, Your Honor, we don't. But even if it's acknowledged by this court that it serves an employer's purpose, there's always an employer's purpose served by an employee going to work. The issue here is whether or not they can satisfy the dual purpose test of whether or not they would have gone to work but for the fact that they were paid. Would they have gone if the errand was solely for the employer?
No, they go because they want to keep their job.
Well, perhaps if that had been the issue here, but it wasn't. They were being paid. They had a personal reason for going, the same as anyone else was going to work. That personal reason was to be paid. I think it's also fairly evident that a safety meeting serves the personal purpose of an employee, that their own safety is in their own interest. Also, the courts have looked at the underlying trip to analyze whether or not the dual purpose test is satisfied. And they went home for the weekend, as the record evidence shows, which would tend to indicate that their reasons were personal for going home. And the courts have said that ever since this court said it in the bottom, that if the person goes home first and serves a personal purpose, and the trip back is also personal. On the burden of proof, then, respondent contends that the only issue is the sufficiency of movement's proof, whether or not we satisfied our burden to therefore shift it to petitioners. Mr. Bogus will address the first two prongs of the course of employment test, but I'd like to talk about the third prong on which petitioners rely so heavily. They say that there are numerous issues remaining in this case, and yet there are three issues that they are certain in their writ application, well down to only one. They say that the burden was shifted as to the deviation exception. The deviation exception, of course, is a subset of the special mission exception, which this court in Freeman said was subsumed by the statutory directed and employment exception. So we're talking here about one issue that they claim has not been resolved. We feel that it has, because deviation was not raised in the court below. They raised it for the first time on appeal. They made a tardy effort to bring their situation within the directed and employment effort by alleging that they were deviating from their regular route to work. Despite the holding in Clear Creek that they were precluded from raising this issue, and that only insufficiency of evidence could be raised if it had not been raised in the trial court. What petitioners are doing here is using the court's protection of being able to raise the insufficiency evidence on a point on appeal to combine it with a phantom deviation issue, and thereby impermissibly raise something for the first time on appeal in spite of the purpose and specific language of Rule 166A that was intended to preclude appellate courts from considering issues the trial courts had not had presented to them. Respondent contends that if petitioner is heard in this court on deviation, there will be possibly adverse consequences. Surely there will be an injustice to the respondent, because this court will be forced to choose between either accepting the motion for judicial notice or the unfortunate dilemma of judging a portion of the case on an incomplete record. Because the issue was not raised at trial, no evidence was adduced about it. And this is what the Court of Appeals was trying to say when they talked about the fact that there was no evidence. Simply that we had met our burden and petitioners did not go forward and meet theirs.
Those matters you wanted for this court to take judicial notice of, wasn't that your burden to present that evidence to the trial court?
No, Your Honor, we don't think so. Deviation was not raised at the trial court. At the trial court, petitioners simply alleged that there was a one-half-hour time change in the meeting, that they would not have been on the train tracks when they were but for the safety meeting. And in point of fact, under Bales and other cases, a time change of this nature is not sufficient to justify the terming of a mission as special.
And in response to your motion for summary judgment, did they not allege that they were on a special mission?
They alleged that they were on a special mission, but they didn't allege the deviation exception to the special mission. And we negated the regular special mission exceptions by our contention in the trial court. I'd like, before my time is completely up,
to refer the court briefly. This map, which I know might be difficult for some of you to see, but this is a blow-up of Exhibit E, which you've already received with the motion for judicial notice. And it indicates that the collision site is well north of both the Ranch Creek work site and the safety meeting work site, and that therefore, even if deviation were accepted as a theory, they have not yet reached the point of deviation. The men started from Evans Home, which is in Gainesville, up in this area, and they were eastbound on this paved but unnamed county road when a collision occurred here. The green line indicates their intended line of direction. They would have turned right and proceeded past the Ranch Creek work site to reach the safety meeting work site. Now, had they lived elsewhere, and I hope I can address your question here, if they had lived south, they would not have had to deviate to get to the safety meeting because they would have reached it first. And if they had lived east or west, they could well have taken the same road as they normally took. And if the collision had occurred before the point of deviation, the result would be the same in this case, or as we contend that it should continue to be in this case.
You're saying they weren't actually on a deviation at the very time the accident occurred.
That's correct. And they nowhere allege that in their Court of Appeals brief or in their application for writ. They very carefully avoid saying that by simply talking about the fact that the safety meeting was not at the construction site.
Is this in evidence?
No, unfortunately it isn't, Your Honor. We contend that it isn't in evidence for the sole reason the deviation was not raised as an issue in the trial court. It would have been very easy, and in fact would have been done. This map would have been submitted in evidence if we'd been put on notice and timely apprised of the fact that they were going to raise the deviation issue. We contend that there are a number of reasons why they did not, including the fact that the trial court might well have known that the collision site, which was known to them because they sit in that county, was north of both of the sites that were being described, or that the evidence could easily have been entered if they had alleged it at that time. They also didn't want to allege it at the trial court because they would have run the risk of perjury, because it's a simple fact that they were not deviating.
Well, if they had passed the work site on the way to the safety meeting site, would that have been a deviation?
It might have been a deviation, but under Texas law, it still would not have been a special mission because they would have had to have been performing a service as they traveled down the road. As they were in Janak and Johnson, the only Texas cases that are cited by the petitioner in this case. And the reason, by the way, that we did not distinguish the foreign cases that were brought in on this point was that we feel that they're inapposite. Texas law is settled on this issue, and what petitioner is trying to do is ask this court to change established Texas law. There must be something more than a mere deviation from a route to go to an alternate work site before this court should find special mission based on established Texas law.
If we're talking about deviation of a route, have there been any cases or anything to indicate that there's a deviation of time of travel? They're 30 minutes earlier than they would have been. And you could very well make the argument that had they gone to the job site at the usual time, they had missed that train.
Your Honor, that's perfectly true, but that's part of the risks and hazards of the general public being on the road.
Yes, but their
work site...
The only point I'm really trying to talk about is when we talk about deviation, you're just talking about deviation of a travel route.
That's right.
Not travel, not deviation from standard procedure.
That's true, but we contend that the deviation in time, the half an hour time change, was not a deviation either in the sense that you're using it, because quite frankly, it was to be their new work time from that point forward, as the record shows. It was to be their new work time because of taking advantage of daylight hours from that time until the end of April.
And please report, Jeff Boggs will continue arguing for respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Jeff Boggess. I have somewhat less than 5 minutes, and I will try to hurry through this. Susan has laid out the three-pronged course of employment test that this court established in the bottom cases decided in 1963. I want to address the first two prongs of that. Now, it is our position that the petitioners, if we come forward if we came forward in the trial court and offered evidence that conclusively negated the existence of just one of those three prongs of the course of employment test, then that we're entitled to summary judgment. The petitioner's position is, if they satisfy the fourth statutory exception found in Article 8309, Section 1B, that is, that they were directed to proceed from one place to another in the course of their employment, that that satisfies the first two prongs of the test, which are found in the definition of injury in the course of employment found in Article 8309, Section 1. That is not the law. That this court specifically rejected that argument in the case of Maryland Casualty Company versus Thomas. That's a decision of the San Antonio Court of Appeals. This court must overrule Thomas in order to reverse this case. In the Thomas case, a truck driver whose job it was to drive, a truck driver was instructed by his employer to stop work, go to his home, get some rest, and then come back several hours later at 11 o'clock at night so that he would be ready to perform a special task for the employer requiring alertness. The truck driver did as he was instructed, and on his way back to work, he was involved in a vehicular accident. The San Antonio Court of Appeals, in that case, reversed the trial court judgment for the plaintiff and rendered judgment for the carrier on the face of that evidence, and said that evidence conclusively showed that the man was not injured in the course of his employment. The Court of Appeals, the San Antonio Court of Appeals in that case, cited this court's 1963 decision in Bottom and said, specifically held, that the plaintiff had to satisfy the first two prongs of the course of employment test as well as the third. Clearly, the plaintiff's evidence in the Thomas case satisfied the third prong, and he was a truck driver, but that wasn't enough. He had to satisfy the first two prongs, and the San Antonio court reversed and rendered. This court refused the application for writ of error outright. You must reverse Thomas in order to reverse this case. Now, why is that important in this case? What does the evidence show in this case? Our evidence showed that the proof conclusively established that the injuries did not have anything to do with and did not originate in the work business of the employer Railroad Builders. And the proof that we adduced on this issue showed that the men were not supposed, they were not going to be paid until they showed up at work and punched in at 7:30 at the site of the safety meeting. They were not going to get paid till then. Their work day didn't commence until that point. 7:30. They had no other duties until 7:30 in the morning, and their duty at that time was attendance. That's the same kind of evidence that we had in Thomas. And yet, here, the plaintiff is saying, well, they had some duty trying to go down the road. In the Bottom case, this court reversed a trial court judgment for the widow for death benefits and rendered judgment for the carrier. In that case, the deceased worker was a truck driver who was injured while returning to his employer's premises in Dallas from visiting his home in Hillsboro when he was involved in a fatal vehicular collision. This court held that because he went to his home on the first place on a personal mission, his injuries did not originate and had anything to do with his employer as required by 8309 Section 1. This court would have to reverse the Bottom case in order to reverse the holding here. And we suggest that's certainly inappropriate. We would also direct the court's attentions, as we have in our brief, to the cases of Smith versus Dallas County Hospital District and the Loofbrew case out of the Waco Court of Appeals. Both of those are NRE decisions. In both of those cases, the courts of appeals affirmed summary judgments for the defendant carrier. In both of those cases, the summary judgment evidence established that the employees were doing no work for the employer while they were traveling down the road. In one of those cases, the plaintiff was being paid for her time and spent traveling to her place to her home after returning after having reported to the hospital employer on an emergency on-call status. And yet, the court denied recovery. The court affirmed summary judgment for the employer. The court said if the employees in those cases weren't doing anything while they were traveling down the road, their injuries didn't originate in the course of employment. That's all I have. I see that my time has expired, and I apologize for exceeding my time limit. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear rebuttal argument.
Just a couple of brief points, if I may. All of the cases that counsel just referred to you and went through with you to some extent factually, I would submit are not special mission cases. In all of those cases, the employee was not specially or specifically directed by the employer to do anything. And in all of those cases, the employee was either proceeding from home to work or from work to home, which is the normal to and from situation, excluded from coverage under the comp law. On the issue of whether the safety meeting was an alternate job site, I don't believe there's any specific law. There aren't any specific cases that are directed, not in our jurisdiction. But I would refer the court, and I did not do this in my brief, to Professor Larson's treatise in Volume 1 of Workers' Compensation Law, Section 15.45, where Professor Larson says that in the case of road construction workers, the premises or the job site, which is the issue there, is the portion of the highway under construction. To say it another way, as it applies to our situation, the job site or the premises here is the actual site to which they were assigned to work, the Range Creek Bridge job site. They weren't going there, they were going to a safety meeting. With respect to the respondent's motion to take judicial notice, although the insurance company is now taking the position that we raised this issue for the first time, that is the deviation issue, and that it has not had an opportunity to present these facts, it requests the court to judicially notice. That's not accurate. It is true that the insurance company did not address the issue of deviation in the trial court. We did. I did so in my motion to brief for partial summary judgment at transcript page 89, I believe. However, the insurance company failed to respond to it. Of course, they made no attempt at that point to introduce this evidence at the trial court where it should be properly considered. They also made no attempt to introduce this evidence at the appellate court level, even though they argued the deviation issue in pages 40 to 48 of their appellate brief before the Court of Appeals. They're now asking at the very last minute that this court take judicial notice of facts that should not be judicially noticed anyway at this late stage for the wrong reasons. They shouldn't be judicially noticed because all of the judicial notice cases that they cited to you were cases involving whether a city or a county, appropriate county lines, or whether a municipality is in a county and things of that nature that can easily be ascertained and determined from official records. They're asking you to judicially notice facts here about where a particular residence is that has a rural route number, where a location is on a particular highway, things that should not under any circumstances be judicially noticed. Most of the cases that they cite on judicial notice are cases that support our position. There is no Texas Supreme Court case where this court judicially notices facts. The Balsing and the Texas Securities Court versus Peters case that are cited in their motion are cases that support the proposition that this court or an appellate court may presume facts under certain circumstances to be in support of the trial court judgment, but not that this court may judicially notice these facts or any other facts of this nature, particularly not when they had a summary judgment burden below and did not present this evidence below. In the Barber case that they cited, which is this court's 1967 case, the Supreme Court upheld the trial court's judicial notice of an act occurring in a particular county in that case, but the Supreme Court did not take judicial notice of that fact. In the Sparkman versus Maxwell case, the 1975 case that they refer to, the court refused to take judicial notice in that case of a state publication, an official state publication. In the Farrell versus Sutpin case, the Fort Worth Court of Appeals case that they cited, it's actually a case that I'm going to cite in my brief if the court gives me an opportunity to brief this issue.
The court there refused to take judicial notice of the fact that the city of Arlington is in Tarrant County. And the only case that they do cite for this proposition, which I think is a fairly radical proposition, is the City of Dallas versus Moreau case, which is a recent Dallas Court of Appeals case where the Dallas Court of Appeals did indeed take judicial notice of a chapter of the Dallas City Charter. And that was the first time that the court had been requested to take judicial notice of it. I would point out, however, that that matter was fully argued by the parties without objection at the trial court hearing on the motion for judgment NOV, as it's recited in the court.
Counsel, to be on a special mission, that implies that you're at work, correct?
Well, I think to state it a little differently, I think that if you are directed on a special mission by your employer, the courts assume that work begins when you leave to go to the special mission, or you're on your way.
To take you out of the transportation to and from work exception.
Absolutely. Yes, sir.
And the Court of Appeals specifically found that the plaintiff in this case had not begun working at the time of their injuries, but were traveling to work.
That's
correct. Were traveling to the safety meeting.
Which the Court of Appeals assumed to be work, which I think is an incorrect assumption, and which I think the summary judgment evidence conflicts on.
You're just saying there's a fact issue.
I'm saying there's a fact issue. I think that's the fair and most cautious approach to this case. There is a fact issue. Perhaps I didn't carry my summary judgment burden below, but certainly the defendant failed to carry its summary judgment burden. And because of that, I think the case should be remanded so we can have the good people in Grayson County try it.
Counsel, are you saying that the Supreme Court may only take judicial notice of law and not judicial notice of facts?
No, I'm saying, Your Honor, that I think my personal opinion, although there's no law on this, is that the Supreme Court may certainly take judicial notice of certain facts. However, these are not the sort of facts that this court or any other court may take judicial notice of, because they're just not easily ascertainable from official records and documents. And I'm also saying that there is no Texas Supreme Court case where this court, for the first time, as the respondent is now requesting, this court takes judicial notice of facts that were not raised below. Substantively, I am not suggesting, as the respondent contends, that this court abolish or expand or extend the to-and-from rule. I'm merely suggesting that the court follow what I perceive to be fairly well-established law in this area, although the cases are scanty. They turn on the particular facts, and that's the reason that the summary judgment burdens are so significant. On the other hand, I think that the insurance company is taking the position in a variety of their arguments, primarily since these fellows they went home before they began their special mission, that as a matter of law, it can't be a special mission, and a number of other arguments that the insurance company raises. For the court to buy that argument or those arguments, the court would have to, I think, radically restrict the notion of special mission in Texas as it's been judicially interpreted. Procedurally, it's a very sparse summary judgment record. Genuine issues of material fact exist, and I would request that the court send this back so we can get those resolved.
I'm going to grant a plan to respond
I would request an opportunity to respond in brief form.
How much time do you want?
Given my trial commitments, could I have 15 or 20 days?
How about 10?
The court's order.
Your Honor, we don't have any objection to 15 or 20 days if the court so chooses.
15 days. Is that all right?
Yes, sir.
15 days.
7 days to respond if they want to.
And 7 days to respond?
Thank you.
All right, that completes the business of the court, and the cause is submitted on oral arguments and written briefs. That concludes the business of the court, and Marshall will please adjourn the court.
Okay. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas.